So who'd like to kick off with some questions? John?
Look as though I've got questions for everybody, actually, but I wonder if I could just start briefly with Martin. The point you made about the ring fence budget for public health in local authorities, would it be something by implication that you would support the continuation of?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, or it could be around, I mean, it could be budgets or it could be around staffing, you know, one or the other, or a mixture of both.
Because strictly speaking, what you said is correct. There is no commitment to a ring fence budget beyond 16-17. But a recent National Audit Office report on local authority spend seemed to imply that it believed the ring fence should stay, and indeed the Chief Exec of Public Health England has also said so. So, I mean, it could be that the committee would want to consider whether that should be a recommendation from this committee as well. Angela, in a very rapid way, you've sort of described what I think is the real position, regardless of food banks and acute hunger. I mean, the real manifestation of poverty and diet is overconsumption, but of the wrong things, and the obesity is a disease of poor people, effectively. You gave us some potential things to consider, but I was struck by the evidence that you gave us of, you know, how in fact if you just cut out fruit and veg, you save yourself money, and what solutions might the committee explore around preferential pricing, if you like, or indeed Martin, you know, or indeed Adam might want to contribute. I mean, is there some more concrete scheme that the committee should look at around preferential pricing of health and food?
Well, actually, they might be better able to respond on the correct economic response. But I would also say that in terms of fruit and vegetable consumption, it links to one of Martin's points. It's not just about the price; it's also about people's perception of whether or not they will be eaten. And so, I do know that mothers from lower income groups will say, we will tend to buy food that we know the children are going to eat. And fruit and veg are often left, I mean, we have the same in our household, fruit and veg are often left in the fruit bowl at the end of the week. And so I can afford that, and I might even make some kind of crumble with it, but I might not. But there's an issue, I think, with fruit and veg and avoidance of waste as well. So I don't think it's not just purely financial, but you can see there is a price elasticity there. And so if you could start to reduce healthier food, the price of healthier foods, I think that would be good.
There's a recent paper showing fruit and veg prices have gone up more than processed food prices in the last 2 years. So, you know, I mean, I think you can look at issues like that and recommend something. But I'm struck by Angela's slide about across Europe, the southern climates and high income eat more fruit and veg. Northern climate, people from northern climates, my reading of the slide was, eat less fruit and veg. There's a cultural preference here as well.
Tastes better as well.
And tastes better. Well, it gives you more, it's immediate. You know, you eat energy dense food and you hit it immediate because it's high in fat, salt, and sugar. You know, I think that obesity may be a disease of poverty, but it's not a separate group that are going hungry. It's hungry. It's largely the same group. Mothers, particularly, will often go hungry at times of the month to feed their children or to be able to put food on the table. So they're not separate. Everybody thinks this is the hungry and then there's the obese. They're not. They're largely the same group.
Did you want to say something?
Not really. I mean, the whole sort of, wherever you are in terms of applying behavioural economics, it's just bringing forward particular proposals, but most of the time people are not sort of excluding other proposals. So even the people, the libertarian paternalists, they say that, you know, regulation may work in some context, prices may work in some context, but that they're not the tools of behavioural economics or nudge, right? But nevertheless, they don't necessarily dismiss them. I mean, pricing policy around other things, such as cigarettes, I think that's been shown to be the most effective tool. But that's usually taxation policy, isn't it? It's increasing prices to try to reduce demand. It'd be interesting to see whether, it'd be interesting to see whether it works or not.
We're looking at food banks and a million people depending on food banks. Food banks, by and large, distribute processed food because it's easier to store. I mean, there are a number of pilot projects going on across the country. Liverpool, I'm aware of, some in London, supplying fresh fruit and veg through the networks. But that is a logistical problem for food banks who may be operating out of the back of a church hall. But, you know, if food banks, and I've got problems with this, if food banks are going to be a feature of the landscape, we need to look at them supplying fresh fruit and veg to the most vulnerable inner societies. But that has a they're not going to do that overnight because that has storage problems, it has handling problems, you know, getting fruit and veg from the industry. So it won't sit for 3 weeks or 4 weeks like some of the other goods they currently have in stock. Now, I might want to have a separate discussion about food banks, but I'm not advocating food banks as the way forward.
Perfect, Dan.
Yes, I'm really struck by how when you tie all of you are saying together, it's this move towards it's all about individual choice rather than structural solutions that can be put. And it's really worrying because then it starts saying, oh, well, all these poor people are making the wrong decisions and it's their own fault, which is what then it leads on to the things in the health service about denying care to people who are obese and so on. So I just wanted to ask, really. Of course, there are elements of personal choice here, and there are all sorts of people who are wealthy who will be overweight and obese, but it's the general picture, isn't it? And I suppose it's how do we build into the public policy makers and decision makers or recommendations that would encourage not looking at blaming individuals, but at changing the environment within which people are making decisions in a way that recognises that there's all sorts of forces that are pushing you to do the unhealthy thing. And I think that's the bit that's missing, really, from what you were describing, isn't it? It's the nudges that are there in all the wrong directions that we don't acknowledge, but that have got other interests behind them.
You'd have to change people's ideology or positions of power, and that might be quite difficult to do.
From what would you think would be helpful for us to recommend to try and look at those arguments?
Can I pick up Adam? I mean, I think Adam's point is right. I mean, behavioural economics is not food policy. It's part of food policy. There are numerous other instruments there. I think the responsibility deal, to some extent, has been a success, SALT. But the SALT campaign started before with the FSA, don't forget it. And it's the problem with the responsibility deal, it's an agreement with the industry, in my perspective. We've got a paper on this, which I'm happy to give to you. Industry with the responsibility deal rewrote the responsibility deal. I don't have a problem with that. That's what I expect industry to do. I do not expect government to allow them to rewrite the responsibility deal. That's my problem. So they rewrote it and changed it so that there are buy-ins in the responsibility. You can say, we will educate our customers, but you don't have to commit to offering low-calorie options. So you can pick and choose depending on what sort of company you are. You know, if you're a soft drink company, you can commit to offering alternatives, but not to changing your base product. So in terms of policy, you go back to what Adam was saying, you use behavioural economics to inform the policy basis. But the problem is policymakers are in a framework at the moment of the new regulation is deregulation. That's what they believe. The minister said it a couple of weeks ago. I do not believe in regulation. We will not regulate. So we have a problem. You ask people out there, do they support some of these bans? People generally say yes. I want my kids protected. Depends where you pitch these. So there's a popular imagination, which isn't just about the behaviour. It's about a sense of politics and fairness. If you say, I want to protect kids, people will live with restrictions, whether that be school meals, closing school gates at lunchtime. I'm told I'm not supposed to call them closed gates. They're stay-in policies. But actually, you know, you shut the gates at lunch and there's one solution. You provide better meals in schools is the next part of that. And people say, yeah, I buy into that. If you say, let's have a sugar tax, people say no. You say, let's have a sugar tax aimed at children. That's a very different process.
Do any of the others want to
comment? I just think the industry is too powerful, basically. I mean, you look at the cheese and chocolate manufacturers, they lobby at both the EU level, I think, and at the UK government level to discourage mandatory food labelling on their products. If you look at the cigarette manufacturers, they kick back against plain packaging. I mean, plain packaging is linked to behavioural economics. You know, you make your packaging fancy and attractive, and in the immediate moment, people seem to be more attracted to purchasing those particular products. You make them plain, and there's evidence to show that the demand for them goes down somewhat. The government were going to introduce plain packaging. The cigarette manufacturers kicked up a huge fuss about it, and the government retracted their plan on that. So,
In terms of kind of changing the way in which policymakers think and getting them to react to something that we think through all the time. So in terms of some strategies, we would always present, you know, very good, quite high quality evidence, because obviously people who are working in government are quite intelligent people who know how to read evidence. And when they see flaky arguments, then they will dismiss something immediately. And the other thing is to put something about the cost of not acting. And especially if it's the cost to the health service or to another service. So, for instance, there are loads of reports about the cost to society of obesity. And actually, if you think of something else, if you think about the living wage, I think that there's a bit more government support behind that, because they realise that actually the companies paying poor wages has been a cost to government, because they've been subsidising companies through tax credits and so forth. And I think they realise that. And so you could probably utilise some similar type of argument along the lines of, are you subsidising the food companies or manufacturers to have higher margins at cost to the health services? There's some things to think through there in terms of how you put across messages, I think.
I think we need to move away from the blame issue.
that's the sort of gist of it.
And you know, the problem is the policymakers focus on easy solutions such as cooking, and I'm a long term supporter of cooking, but cooking doesn't solve the problem of people's poverty.
I think that's quite a good hand over to you, Jeanette, to ask some questions.
Okay. Martin, one of the questions I've got was about the food banks and the right type of food, because I don't think it's the right type of food that is actually going into. But we've spoken about policy. What I'd like to look at is, what do we do on the ground? Because, you know, the guys on the ground are getting so much misinformation and so much different information. How can we pull all of this together? And there are so many people doing so many things. So, for instance, you've got Jamie Oliver, you know, doing one thing, Food for Life, obviously, Children's Food Trust, I mean, Food Nation. I can keep going on and on and on. And we've all got similar outcomes, but they're not the same. And so people are getting confused on the ground. How do we help those people? I mean, for me, one is a lot of people can't cook. Martin, you said the poor can't afford to eat locally. But do they know how to buy locally?
Well, they may or they may not, but the rich equally don't. All our data shows the rich are equally de-skilled, but they can buy their way out of it. So in terms of food poverty, the rich can buy their way out of situations like that. I think, I mean, I'm not saying skills are not important. If you're in poverty and you don't have skills and knowledge, that makes your situation worse. But it's not the reason you're in food poverty. That's the point I would make.
Okay.
I think there's an issue here about coordination. There's multiple agendas, you know. We've seen a split up of some services. We've seen celebrity policy making, all to be welcomed, you know, Jamie Oliver's initiative, but it's not influencing policy. I go back to public health and say public health should be doing this, and we should have some united voice around this, and we should agree what we're funding. We have projects being, my terminology, there's a famous German sociologist who calls a lot of these projects successful failures. They're success because they give profile, but if we were measuring them on any outcome criteria, we wouldn't fund them. And food banks fall into that category. They're successful because they meet a niche. They hit the policy agenda. Are they successful? If we use strict criteria, probably not. So I go back to public health, which now has the lead at local authority level. I think you should make recommendations to Public Health England and say, around food, I don't think this is, for me this isn't about nutrition, this is about food. I think it's broader, so I think you've got to make some, to Public Health England, to the Directors of Public Health, the Association of Directors of Public Health, is it, John, I think it's, the faculty can say, you've got to lead on this. This has got to be evidence-based, and you've got to support things in this way. I think there's too much activity out there. Lots of activity, which is to be welcome, but it's not sustainable, because we're not... I would recommend the committee look at the guidance from NICE, the Coronary Heart Disease Prevention Public Health Guidance, which says we should fund local projects for a minimum of 3 years. Because it takes them a year to set up, it takes them a year to deliver, and a year to evaluate any outcomes. So if you're going to set up cooking projects or demonstration projects or food supply projects, you need to think of funding for 3 years. Most projects out there are surviving on 6 months funding. They're absolutely hanging on the skin of their teeth. And that they just won't survive. Or they'll morph into something else. I mean, that's a real thing.
Yeah, just a thought. I mean, it just linked to something that you said, Martin, which is that, I know somebody in PHE who's beginning to look at food poverty and is concerned about it, and I know people in DH who think about nutrition and have responsibility for low income. And it seems to me that, again, in terms of winning the argument and making a case, that it would be useful. I mean, I don't know if you're speaking to them, but to speak, to know where they are at the moment in terms of their thinking, so that you can move it on, because there are people thinking about this.
Okay. One comment on that: we are planning to produce an interim report, hopefully by the middle of March, which will try and pull together the things we've heard from you, with perhaps one or two headline ideas that we've come up with, but also looking to encourage people to ask those very basic questions of the people who are going to ask to be elected by those people about what kind of approach you want to take to dealing with food and poverty issues. So, and our final report won't come out until after the next election, when we know who the next government is. And maybe what you're saying there is something we need to think about in interacting with whoever the next government is before we do our final report.
I was just thinking about the officials, who are currently working on it. But okay.
Thank you, Neil.
sorry, I wasn't here for your presentation, Martin. So I found the phrase that I think Adam used, redesigning choice architecture, quite interesting. But that actually, although it sounds a bit abstruse, for me, bridges the kind of the polar thing between behaviour and structures, and you kind of get put into, are you about behaviour or are you about structures? But actually the point of that is people make behaviour choices within an architecture, and if you want them to change their choices, then you've actually got to change the whole structure, the architecture, not just so I'll come to you that I'm a sceptic about behavioural change and small scale change, because it's changing one thing here, and there's a million other things which are making that a completely pointless thing. So I'm interested whether, in any context, whether it's behavioural economics or public health, has had a large-scale impact on people's behaviour health. Because we're talking about wanting to make large-scale impact. And it is, in the end, about people's behaviour, people eating better food, which is behaviour. But to do that requires something, to my mind, a larger category than just a little nudge here or there. So I want some, please give me something from a different context that you could say this initiative actually had, the kind of levelling impact that we want, and if we replicated that or changed that into a food and poverty context, that would really achieve something, worth doing.
Okay.
I'm in agreement. I mean, you know, I think the thing about food is food has emotional complex. I have a bad day, I buy a bar of chocolate. I have a good day, I buy a bar of chocolate. And the price doesn't matter to me. You know, it's complex because food has meaning over and beyond economic issues. It's about taste, culture, etc. But I think if you said, the thing I would say is not about food at all. It's about inequality. If you address inequality, all the countries that have better food outcomes have lower inequality levels. It goes back to the Black Report, goes back to the health divide, goes back to John Hill's recent new book on inequality. Address inequality, that's the way to do it. And food will follow. I mean, the implications of that sort of minimum wage, living wage, that's what we do. The price wars at the moment come with, 49 stores, Tesco stores are about to shut, jobs are going to go. Greencore, the supply chain company, are letting go 300 people at the moment, with another 1,000 to go. The huge inequalities in our system at the moment. And they're just food ones, I'm not even talking about non-food companies.
That's
right,
Colin.
Well, exactly.
Thank you.
You can't expect anybody to live a healthy life if they haven't got enough money.
Well, I mean, I'm in favour of making things far more equal than they are. I'm not so sure that, one thing will necessarily follow the other, that if you reduce inequalities, then you'll get reductions in, the types of food that people eat. I mean, it might be that some of these countries that have a narrow income distribution are just more cohesive societies, and there might be stronger senses of particular norms running through those societies. But that's not to say that I don't believe in reducing inequalities in income. I absolutely do believe in that. But I don't think you necessarily have to use other things as a justification for doing that. It's just good in and of itself. In terms of your points about architecture, I mean, this is a phrase that the libertarian paternalist came up with, this choice architecture thing. I think it's just a fancy phrase for saying the environment or the context or something like that. How they've used it, though, in the nudge agenda is that, like the public health responsibility deals, they've not made them compulsory. It's not mandatory. It's not regulation. So the supply side is open. It's free to do what it wants still. What I would prefer is to use that as forms of regulation. So you say to the supermarkets, you can no longer place chocolate and sweets at your counters. You'll lose some money from the manufacturers of chocolates and sweets because they pay lots of money to place these things in particular locations, but you shouldn't be allowed to do that. I regulate against that personally. There'd be a huge kickback and you probably wouldn't be able to do it anyway. But that's at least the thing that I put forward. In terms of having a big effect, I think you've touched upon something very important regarding this kind of nudge agenda, is that it's being oversold and overbought by policymakers. So the evidence is just not there, really, on sustained effects in many instances at all in this whole agenda. It's just something that's good to think about. I thought that the most prominent and the most successful public health campaign in this country over the last 30 years was the reduction in the incidence of smoking behaviours, and that came about through a whole range of different policies. So there were, there were price policies, there were information campaigns, and norms have changed. Norms have changed in society. So 30 years ago, probably 40 years ago, people thought it was perfectly okay to smoke. It's normal now, in the UK and the US at least, it's frowned upon to smoke. It's the same with cleaning up dog mess in the streets. People just used to let their dogs do what they wanted 30 years ago, didn't they? Now it's a big, social taboo to let your dog mess in the street without cleaning it up. So you get these kind of, it seems to be a tipping point where the social norm changes against particular things in society. So I don't know whether that's something that might be aimed for with food policy as well.
Can I just say, I think the question you asked is for policymakers, is they ask what sort of society they want in relation to food. I mean, I agree. I mean, raising or reducing income levels on its own, but we make the assumption that places like France and Italy have cohesive culture. They're not. They regulate. They actually regulate their societies around food. They regulate their food supply. It's not an accident. I mean, there's a culture, but they also do regulate. I mean, that's the message I take away. The northern countries, it's kind of slightly different. There is more cohesiveness. So I don't think you just do one thing, but I think lowering inequality would have benefits. You then have to change culture alongside that. But I think ask policymakers what sort of food culture or food society they want in the next 10 years. You know, we're going to see more local shops. They're all going to be Tesco and Morrison's. That's what's going to happen. And that may be good or bad. I'm not making any...
Well, maybe not Tesco.
Well, they're going to move into... The 49 stores won't be local stores that shut down, because that's the move. That's the move to the future.
Andrew.
Right. Well, I'm in a difficult position of having been both a policymaker and somebody working for the food industry, so I have few friends on that table. But just to reiterate what I said in the introduction, I'm not speaking with either hat on, but trying to use my experience from both sides of the fence, as it were, to bring some understanding on a personal level as well, because I find the older I get, there are real paradoxes around some of this stuff. And that's really what the area that I'd like to focus on. And these terms are used sort of interchangeably, but they're not interchangeable. Cost, price, and value. They're all rather different concepts in relation to food supply. Can I just ask you, Martin, a factual question? Early on, you talked about we were back to 1997. In what sense did you mean?
Relative prices, the spend on food on average is back to where we were in 1997.
Having gone from what to what?
Having gone down
and now going back up. So food is becoming
more
expensive in real terms.
Death result statistics from
now,
last
year. I think that's probably right. I mean, for most of my working life, in real terms, food prices have gone on a pretty consistent linear decline. And certainly, if you look in terms and, you know, I find this is actually a better comparator than monetary value. If you look at things like the time it took you working to earn the cost of a loaf of bread or the cost of a pint of milk, again, that very, very steep decline. And I think that has plateaued, and it's maybe a little bit of a hockey stick, and where it goes from there, I don't know. Of course, one of the factors in the sort of the hockey stick thing is the cost of oil, because fossil fuels... oil is a major component of food manufacturing, not just the obvious things, tractors, but chemicals, fertilizers, etc., etc., not to mention all the costs of production, the energy. So, you know, how much of the current drop in the oil price will feed through into food prices, I don't know. But coming on to the paradox, even with that, even with a little bit of an upturn, we've still got milk producers saying they are producing below the cost of production. We've got, and I think the point you've made, Andrew, which is, again, a sort of paradox, these wonderfully, these big food companies, whatever, paying their workers relatively low pay, but they would argue that that's what's affordable for them as businesses, because although some of their profits are big numbers, they are also very, very big businesses. And if you look at the rate of return in the food industry, it's certainly no better than most other industries, and possibly slightly worse than most other industries. And, you know, venture capitalists are busy disinvesting in food companies for that very reason, because they can take that money and put it into another area of activity and earn more. So you've got a real paradox there, that food is perceived as expensive in some ways. If you're a producer, it's not perceived as expensive at all. And then putting one of my other older hats on, the sustainability environmental hat on, from a purely environmental perspective, food is not expensive enough, because most of the really damaging effects of food production in environmental terms are not reflected in the price. The use of water, the loss of biodiversity, greenhouse gas emissions, you know, there is a proxy cost of some of those, mainly around energy, through carbon taxes or whatever. But the big ones, water is a major one, biodiversity another major one, those aren't costed at all. And if you had the cost of, or the price of food reflecting its true environmental cost, and if you monetize that, internalizing the externalities, food prices would go up very, very considerably. You might then get some rationing through price, in that if you had a correlation between environmental impact and price, leaving aside anything to do with traffic lights or nutrition or whatever, the chances are the animal-based products would go up disproportionately more because they have a relatively greater impact. So you would get a situation where some of the things that you want to have more moderate consumption of would become less affordable, so that would become self-regulating. But at the other end of the scale, a lot of the other things, some of the cheaper fats, sugar and so on, would not necessarily apply. So again, you'd have some paradoxes and you'd have some differences there. So, and then another thing which I talked a bit about cost and price, just coming on to value, and the point that was made early on, we've heard before in our work in this commission, that you know, food is the most elastic item in the budget, particularly for poorer people. And that's about value. There's two aspects to valuing food. We throw away a lot of food. We throw away roughly 30% or more. Very few other items that we buy in our daily lives do we actually throw away before using. Possible exception of clothes. People have wardrobes of clothes that they haven't worn. But you wouldn't go and buy a television and throw it away without having switched it on. You wouldn't go and buy a piece of jewellery and chuck it in the bin because you thought, oh, well, I've already got a necklace, so I don't really need another one, so I'll just chuck that. So people's attitudes to food, the value, and again, in a poorer household, or in any household, if you think, you know, I want to spend money on this, this, and this, well, the bit I'm going to cut down on is food. And that, again, is a paradox, because... Now, I'm not offering, I don't have any solutions to this. If I had solutions, I might have been more successful either as a policymaker or as somebody working for the food industry. But I throw my contribution to this line of questioning is around those three things, cost, price and value, and I'd just be interested in your three perspectives on those points.
So can you help him, Anders, out?
I mean, it is a paradox. I mean, if it depends on what food culture you want. You know, if you ask people, do you want a sustainable food culture, prices will have to go up. We currently pay 3 times for our food across the counter through CAP, you know, equally, and each family spends in subsidy terms, and through environmental damage and pollution. We pay in our taxes for that. So if you built that into a direct equation for food, food prices would go up. The problem is still food prices relative to people's income. That's the issue for me. You know, so if food prices go up, people's income will have to go up. When we may make some decisions to subsidise some certain types of food, oil prices went up in the from 2003. People were speculating. There's no indication oil prices won't go up again. They're like the lowest for 25 years now, less than $50 a barrel. But it means we're subject to a global food supply chain, which could go either way. Is that the food culture we want? Is that the food society we want? Should we be building in more developments for a British food culture? You know, there's still regulations in force. The government is supposed to keep a 30-day stock of potatoes and a 28-day stock supply of wheat to level off prices. They don't. They rely on the global market to do that. But those regulations are still in place from the Second World War, from post-Second World War. You know, if government was more interventionist, they could control some of those food prices. So that's about a culture of governments, a culture... In terms of people buying televisions, I think entertainment has moved home. People, we now, low-income groups are buying more alcohol and drinking it at home because pubs are shutting down. Who's taking over pubs? Supermarkets are taking over pubs because they've got the same planning regulation. So Tesco can buy a pub and turn it into a local store without looking for planning permission. So pubs are shutting down, people are consequently entertaining themselves more at home, so it makes sense to buy whatever, a 50-inch or a 70-inch television because you bring your entertainment at home. I don't actually have a problem with that. That makes sense to me. You're moving your whole cultural entertainment from one area to another.
Do you want to go there?
No, I thought they were good points. I'd have to think about them more to say anything sensible in response.
I'll just make a few points to you, but after I've finished, I'm going to open the floor to everyone else who's here, but I'll gather any comments you want to make or questions you want to make and give people here an opportunity to respond to those. I mean, listening, Martin, I mean, one of the things I think you were telling us is, look, and it's come out from all of you, the key issue is what's our attitude to regulation and what form of regulatory framework are we going to have and how tough is it going to be? But you're saying there's actually something happening that's leading to a really wasteful duplication in local authorities having to refigure out what to do, when in fact we could avoid that waste if there was some way of thinking about that. And so that's a structural issue too, so we need to think about that. And I think we've come up with a really good point. You've talked about good domestic management, and we're saying what actually makes good domestic management sense for some people in a very poor position may seem odd to people in a rich position, but it actually is a good and makes sense. And that's a bridge we have to really face and look at that. So we have to look at those questions. Angela, I think, hopefully in perhaps some of the more detailed work, we can get closer into both the gender and the age differences that are reflected in the health consequences of poverty in relation to people's diet and the outcomes from that. Identifying the right kinds of intervention. And when you talked about Adam, you mentioned that kind of towards the end of your presentation about the private sector knowing about all this stuff. Well, nudges are very slight. At our last meeting, we had a lot of interesting information about the whole advertising and marketing sector. That isn't a nudge, that's an avalanche. I mean, there's a huge amount of work that goes on to create what is a social norm through advertising and increasing product placement, etc., and what you're supposed to do. So what's the relationship between this kind of idea of nudge and the need for more open regulation and what actually we get? We've got a huge amount of...
As you've indicated there, the private sector used what are classified now as public sector nudges in their private sector work for generations. We know that, the way that they place products, the way that they emphasise, particular packaging that they have and all that sort of stuff. They haven't traditionally labelled these particular affects as behavioural economics. They've been labelled by behavioural economists in controlled settings, studying how people make their decisions. But essentially they are using findings of behavioural economics to increase the purchasing of their products, right? They use those for private sector gain, so they're naturally for them, they're aimed towards profit maximisation. The libertarian paternalists, the nudges, they basically put forward the view that we should try to counterbalance the private sector profit maximising nudges with public sector welfare maximising or welfare increasing nudges, right? In a similar sort of way, in this kind of covert type of way. The other approach you could do is, as I talked about, is recognise the private sector nudges and then openly regulate against those if you think they're causing public harm. So that's the essential difference.
Yeah, thank you. And one of the things we need to have are key questions and key ideas for action points for our interim report. Anyway, if anyone... That was just me.
The Netherlands yesterday banned children's advertising and food products to children under 13. Why have they done that and we haven't done that? Complete right. Ban. What's different about the Netherlands?
Thank you. So we need to look at those.
Jeff, I just closed yes. Another question. Assuming we can't do everything through cost-free nudges, tackling this is going to cost some money somewhere. Is there any reliable data about the health costs? And over time, again, a reliable estimate of how much they could be reduced by...
The kind of work that needs to be done is... probably model some of this, but there's work by the National Obesity Observatory, for instance, that looks at the costs of obesity, and a high proportion of that you could attribute to food intake, but not all of it. There's a bit of modelling work to be done. You could look at the reports on the cost of diabetes, so that information could be collated.
NICE have done some modelling as well, so I would look at NICE data for that.
It is a tricky issue though, I think. I mean, you can estimate these costs. I mean, there's thousands of studies on this on there, but there are some studies in the Netherlands that have estimated the cost, the lifetime healthcare costs of the non-healthy living are less than the lifetime healthy costs of the healthy living, because the healthy living live longer.
Yeah.
Sure, but it depends what you cost. You can't always what I'll say. It depends what you cost.
Yeah.
If you cost quality of life, you get a different equation.
Yeah. So smokers are quite cheap, aren't they?
Yeah.
They die quickly. Yeah.
In fact,
that kind of thing.
I heard something, whether it's true or not, I'm not make comparisons between food and tobacco, but I did hear somebody say very recently on Newsnight or something similar that actually the taxation revenue from tobacco exceeded the healthcare costs. So it was actually a positive inflow rather than a net drain on the economy.
But there is data showing the net cost of food in disease patterns is 9%, and tobacco was estimated at 7%. Now that's food in multiple arenas. It's not food just in coronary heart disease or cancer. It's food across the world. So it becomes more difficult, whereas with tobacco it was not a single issue, disease issue, but it was much easier. So, but there are...
I'm
just going to say the example of living wage versus tax credits is a very tangible and direct one for a government, but an example of reducing the costs to the NHS from unhealthy food would require direct evidence of closing hospital beds and taking out capacity, and that is a different scale of economic equation, I think.
Plus the effect is long-term versus a short-term cost. You know, that if we had it, we won't deliver 15 years.
Right, I'd like to offer everyone who's come, and thank you for coming along today, an opportunity to say something if you wish, either to put a question to any of the people who've given evidence or to contribute yourselves. If you are going to do that, please could you just say who you are when you do so. So the floor is yours, folks. I know the one at the back is Helen Crawley, and then Liz Dowler, and then the lady next to her. Right, so we'll take those three points first. Helen.
Hello, I'm Helen Crawley from First Steps Nutrition Trust. I'm a public health nutritionist. Just two quick points. One, I really urge the commissioners to think very carefully about the impact of food quality on maternal, infant and young child health in particular, as that is a really acute area, and we need to make sure that we consider that carefully. And the second thing is, just that slide's been up for quite a while, and this idea of finding new solutions is always very attractive. But we already have in place a number of programmes, for example, Healthy Start, the Welfare Food Scheme, things like community meals, which have been around for a long time, which directly support people in poverty around food, both of which are now dropping like stones, and we are in likelihood of losing them. So I would also say, look at what we've already got that we need to protect in terms of food quality in those areas.
Thanks. Can I encourage you to put in an evidence submission with the key points, do this. We're very interested in action points out of this, not simply recommendations, but action by whom to do what. Thank you. Liz Dowler.
Liz Dowler from the University of Warwick. Thank you. I'll try and be very brief because I've got much voice. I wanted to support what Angela just said about the need for better modelling and a sense of what public health intervention gain might be. The data that Martin quoted about 9%, I believe I'm saying, is now that modelling was done quite some years ago, probably 10 years. It seems to me that actually thinking about public health gain of food has dropped off both political and research agenda. And of course, research needs funding. I know PHE is about, well, they said, 6 months ago, we were about to put out a call for research on food poverty. I haven't seen it, maybe I missed it. And that's a recommendation that sounds a bit esoteric, but I think it's an important part of an argument. And two quick comments on the, I think I remember them correctly, points that Andrew made, which I think is a real conundrum and very helpful. And these are very small additional things. I don't know, I apologise if I missed the beginning of the presentations because of traffic. I don't know whether you talked about indebtedness. And my sense, I can't prove this, but my sense of reading reports by the Which, Consumers Association, and other such things, is that many, many more people, particularly those on low incomes and on very low incomes at the moment, are more indebted now than they were, say, 5 years ago or even 10 years ago. And particularly indebted to those who charge very high interest rates. So the answer to your question, why do people not prioritise food, is because they would like to prioritise food. All the evidence I've seen suggests that. But it's quite impossible, particularly if you have bailiffs at the door or threats of violence or a demand that you're going to lose your home or whatever it is. And of course food comes secondary. You can survive on toast or breakfast cereal. It's not very healthy for a length of time, that's what you need. But if you don't need those debts, they're very critical. And the final point is there's quite growing evidence, both in Britain and I've just come from some work being done in Denmark, Copenhagen, and there are papers in about to be published. I'll see if I can ask for those to be sent to you, showing that as people there, even in Denmark, nothing like the extremes we have here, but nevertheless, people who are having to cut back and change their food practices, what they have been able to demonstrate by quantitative and qualitative work is that people's, if you like, environmental practices are improving, and people generally throw much away. And I know RAP claims that's because of their work, and others say it's because of poverty. It's very hard to drill down and give cause and effect. But both the quantitative and the qualitative supported this, that people really thought a lot about planning menus, buying to a menu, having much less that you throw away. I mean, there's a lot of work going on in Britain about the cultural aspects of throwing food away. I don't think much of it links into very low income and how that changes. The question, of course, is what happens if people's income really goes up? Do they stick with those practices, if that's what you're interested in from an environmental perspective? Is it actually a consequence of having very little money and people change? And I don't think anybody knows the answer to that.
Thank you. At the back.
Yes, hello. My name is Emily Leach. I work as senior director of the Soil Association. One of our key aims as an organisation is to make good food accessible to everyone, whoever and wherever they are. So we have a lot of recommendations to make to you, which we plan to submit. I have one comment and one question, if that's okay. So the comment is that it's great to see, in the discussion at least, a real balance between the need to address food poverty, which is an extreme end of a bigger problem, and then a wider need to address inequality in people's, you know, ability to access and afford good diets. And I think that's the bigger problem that we should be looking to tackle. My question, if I'm allowed at this stage, is linked to the NHS. And actually, you know, when you look at smoking, we've aimed to turn the table on accessibility, affordability and availability, and those are the key things to changing behaviour and culture. Are we going to be able to do that with food if in hospitals bad food is normalised and promoted in, you know, the alleys of the cardiology ward? And what roles the NHS have in leading the way as a food example?
Thanks. Does anyone want to comment on the three comments we've had from the floor at the moment from
The public sector issue is, I mean, they should be setting an example. I mean, you know, we now have hospitals like KFCs in them. For God's sake, what's going on? You know, I go to Southampton, there's a KFC there, and patients queuing up at the KFC in the hospital. This is, you know, this is not an example. I mean, we should extend nutrient guidance to most of the public sector areas. You know, sports facilities, doctor surgeries still have you know, dispensing machines and dispensing soft drinks. I mean, this is just unacceptable. It's not setting an example. Public procurement has a potential to change by leveraging procurement. And we see some of that in Wales, not quite there, but it, you know, the sustainable cities movement is moving that way. There's a lot of movements. We've got sustainable cities, we've got soil association. We need some joined up thinking on this. That's what I think.
Thank you. Anyone else? Right, more questions. Anyone else want to add anything? Okay, you're the last one then.
Patrick Butler from The Guardian. Two questions. First one was to ask about, and Martin mentioned cookery courses. Now, we heard when the Church of England lodged its report before Christmas, War Can't Cook, according to Lady Jenny. As a journalist, often one of the things that people comes to me and I write about as in connection to food is they say we've got this cookery course, and then the local authority or the primary care trust around cookery laws. My question was, is there any data on the effectiveness of community cookery courses? And secondly, is there any data on the number of closures of cookery courses, or as you mentioned, cookery courses that had to close after 6 months rather than 3 years?
Okay, there is evidence showing cooking courses work. I've got this recent systematic review which I can give to the committee. There's some work of the Jamie Oliver program in Australia but it had $6 million. It's of a different nature than Jamie Oliver's kitchen here. So that's the complex. It was a 10-week program showing people change their behaviours at the end, but it wasn't particularly low-income people. There's a systematic review, which I'll make available. That doesn't change people's... People still go back to the situations they live in. Myself and Liz were involved in a project in the early 2000s in Glasgow, where we give people cooking skills. They went home and they weren't cooking. And we asked them why, because their cooker was broken, they're on a meter system, they can't afford to turn on the meter, they haven't got pots and pans, they haven't got, you know, they haven't got things we take for basics, they have not got resources to. So cooking...
Tables
to eat at. Well, you know, we made a submission to the Conservative Public Health Committee saying make dining areas compulsory in all new builds. Well, we never heard back from them on that. You know, you want people to eat together, what you do is you structurally change the situation. So cooking works, but it doesn't necessarily move people out of food poverty. It may help them manage better. That's all it does. Also, community projects use cooking as a means to an end. They use cooking to get people in very often. You know, lots of community workers I know use cooking because it's a social activity. They may have a bit of healthy eating, but actually their agenda is over and above cooking. We have some data on food projects generally, not on cooking projects specifically across the country, folding because of lack of public health funding, because people are just saying, we can't make a commitment. And there's been a big increase in what we call KICs, community interest companies, setting up in communities to fill that void.
Okay.
Oh, there's one second question. The second question is about community shops. You mentioned that food banks, the problems with food banks not having a wide range of food limited in terms of how much they could give out. I'm reading a lot about community shops. In fact, I'm interviewing someone who runs one. there is some suggestion that actually, you know, you could turbocharge food banks by turning them into community shops. And what you solve the problem of the food banks not being able to address the deeper issues of food poverty. I wonder what your views are on community shops.
I mean, I do look to this, but my suggestion is that alternative systems like this, why are they different for the poor? That's my basic point. You know, I don't have a problem. The one that's operating up north in, is it Grant? The one that's Barnsley has been there for 30 years. It's got a wider community base. It's not just the community shop that's been set up. It actually was there during the miners' strike. And the then Conservative government criticised it, saying this is not the way forward. This is serving criminals. Now suddenly it's an acceptable model. I mean, what is going on here? So, you know, there's things like this don't emerge. They don't just happen overnight. The one up north is there for 30 years. There's a plan for 12 in London, as I understand it, still using surplus food from the supermarkets. This goes back to what sort of food society do we want? That's the question. And for me, this is nothing to do with nutrition. It's nothing. It's about a social fairness agenda. I don't think the poor should have to source that. Why aren't retailers going in there? What is planning doing to encourage, you know, here I'm sticking up, don't often find myself arguing for Tesco locals or Sainsbury's locals, but if everybody else has them, why shouldn't the poor have access to them if that's going to be the future? And planning needs to address that. We've got provision in planning, section 103 or 107, I always forget it, where you can ask for added value. So you can say to Tesco, you can open here if you open there. Open a smaller shop there in a low income area. We will allow you. You can actually build things like that in planning. We don't use planning proactively in that way because it's not politically acceptable to use it in that way.
Thanks. We're coming to the end of the time that we've got. You'll all have a brief chance to make one comment. I'm offering the commissioners a chance to add anything else they want to. Liz, did you want to?
I was only going to say that the evidence about cooking camps is that a lot of those who are poorer join such things, hugely enjoy them. I don't think it solves the problems, except that it empowers a very, very small proportion of those in problems, sometimes, and there is evidence of this, to feel better about themselves and their food. But I think Martin's major point is probably certainly more correct. Right. It doesn't change the structure of power.
Okay, anyone from the commissioners want to add any final questions?
What Helen said made me ask the question. I know the health and pregnancy grant didn't last very long, but I wondered whether there was any evidence from the time that it existed that it had any impact, because obviously there was a justification for introducing that vital benefit at that crucial time in mother and baby's lives, and it went to everyone, and so there's a small cohort of people who did get it, and I wondered.
I don't think there's any evidence.
The Surestart maternity grant was based on the evidence from the Gary, Indiana income supplementation study, which showed that babies were born more heavier to mothers who had the supplementation. So there was some evidence for it.
Okay.
But
John,
do
you want to?
There were two things. Are we sort of
we're
sort of
wrapping
finishing?
Up.
Yeah.
Yes, we need to wrap up.
I think
over time,
the point that Angela made on the iron-related studies, and it does highlight for me a need for a return to good old-fashioned public health nutrition research. The other big example is vitamin D and rickets, which we have insufficient but growing evidence on the deficiencies in people's diets there. The other one, which we can't prove on the malnutrition issue, again, it's right to be cautious on that because, you know, with companies pushing parenteral nutrition solutions in hospitals, there is a drive to identify people who are malnourished. It doesn't mean they haven't got it, but it does mean that, there are new imperatives about that. And it does seem to highlight for me a need for community surveys of actual hunger so that we can seriously get to the bottom of malnutrition in the UK. We haven't really gone into the issues of fast food, and the cheapest way to keep yourself going is a bag of chips in terms of calories, and there are, as Martin and Angela are alluding to, there are sound decisions that people are making about what they can afford to eat, and I think we need to return to that in subsequent discussions. The other thing I would say is that we haven't had sufficient time to go into the issues of responsibility deal, and perhaps we can come back to that as well.
Thanks. Right, last words. None from the commissioners. Any from the evidence givers? Yes, Angela.
Just a couple of just final points. Just the issue about cooking lessons. I'm sure you're probably aware of it, but you know that the curriculum in schools has changed, and so it might slightly change the landscape in the future, hopefully for the better. And the other one was that my sources in DWP tell me that they're looking at changing the way in which benefits are provided, and maybe linking to you can spend your money on food, or you can spend your money, like food stamps, and maybe it's just worth thinking that one through. I haven't got anything more to say on that, but I've heard on the grapevine that they're looking at that, because of course the effective poor aren't spending their money correctly.
Okay, well, look.
I can give you evidence on the responsibility deal on fast food. Put down my agenda to do those left out of the 10 minutes.
So. Right, fine. Please supply that. Well, look, can I thank everyone for their time and their interest, especially the three of you for coming along today. And we're, as I said, very open to follow up, and we want to do an open and accessible process throughout. Thanks, everyone. Those of you who are not commissioners and staying after 1 o'clock, please can you clear the room by 1 o'clock? So we've got a follow-up meeting. But you can chat in the corridor, and there's a very good restaurant downstairs, which I recommend.